Chris in Tennessee, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Welcome to the Revere Radio Network, the worldwide home of free speech. My name is Chris. This show is called Nowhere to Run. You can go to our website, which is nowheretorun.podomatic.com or conspiracyclose.com/nowheretorun. I'm going to go ahead and apologize for the iffy sound this week. I'm using my laptop to broadcast this show, so it's going to sound a little crazy, but we'll probably be back to the regular setup next week. Okay, so we got a lot to do today, so we will just go on and get right to it. Let's start off by doing some corrections from the previous shows, so let's do that real quick.
I've just picked up a fault in the AE-35 unit.
It wasn't lies, it was just bullshit.
This sort of thing has cropped up before, and it has always been due to human error.
Okay, the first email and correction is to William, and this is to do with the assertion that it's possible that high-ranking evil entity is bound underneath the pyramid at Giza. And, Frank and I both had put forth an idea and a theory about that, that it could be the location of the biblical abyss. But anyway, the email William writes goes like this. So I have listened to many of you and Frank Lordy's podcasts, and I have a question about something that you and him both regularly refer to, and that is to the fact that Satan is bound in the pit right now. What is your scriptural basis for that assertion? You are not both pre-eternists, so I wonder how you guys can claim it and back it up. And I write to him, I know that's a good question. I know I've misspoke this several times. I know Frank is better about making it clear. Read here first, and I quote this a little bit. First, I quote Revelation 9:11, and they say, and they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in Hebrew tongue is Abaddon. But in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon. And then here is another quote from a website. This, the leader of these locust-like creatures are not literal locusts, because they have a king. And Proverbs 30:27 says, the locusts have no king, yet they all advance in ranks. The king is given a name. Abaddon and Apollyon both have the same thought of destruction or perdition, torment, destruction. Perhaps Apollyon is Satan himself, or another high-ranking leader of demons. And then I continue. Basically, we don't know who the king of this pit is, but he is a high-ranking evil entity. I know that Frank, in his original presentation, made this point rather clear. I know that I tend to gloss over that point, saying Satan, more often than maybe Satan. And, you know, just expanding on that, I do think that the king of this these demonic whatever that are going to be released when the key is open to that, they have a king over them. I don't know, and it's very clear in the Bible, if you read, that there are high-ranking geographical entities, much different than demons. It's like a military system, and they are bound in certain places. Not always. It looks like this place is a lockdown of some sort, but there are other places that they're just bound, like you know, the Prince of Persia and the princes of the and the three. Is it three angels bound at the great river Euphrates? And you know, other things like that. And also, I would like to suggest sometimes when people have haunted houses, they have a particular room or a particular place or foyer or whatever that's, quote, haunted. Well, a lot of times it's not, you know, it's not, in my opinion anyway, a ghost so much as it is a demon that only has a territorial right to a very small area because of rituals or seances or something. They only have a right to one little area, and they'll make you believe, you know, like, they're all kinds of things. They're old women. They'll do anything to make you think that they are not what they are, because if you knew that, you would probably get rid of them and their little slice of this pie that they're given. But anyway, that's really not part of this. I continue in this email. It says, I say here, in looking into this, I realized that I'd always thought of this Apollyon was the entity that ended up indwelling the Antichrist. Although I knew that it would be Satan somehow, too, that would indwell the Antichrist. I guess that's where the confusion came from on my part. I can't find support for this anywhere. Now that I look, I don't know where I heard this, but I must have just taken it as fact. When I did, I will correct some of these mistakes in the next show. So basically, what I was saying there was, I guess I've always, when referring to the king of this pit that gets released, you know, according to Revelation 9:11, it seems to be, I guess I always thought that king was the one that would be released and indwell the Antichrist. Although knowing that it's been Satan's plan for a long time to indwell his man, his is a Jesus type forgery, if you will. So anyway, that's the correction for that. I appears to have misspoke that. If anybody knows where I could have gotten that idea that this Apollyon was going to indwell the Antichrist, let me know that. I would appreciate it. Okay, the next correction is very interesting. It's from the guy who runs johnallegro.org, which is a very pro-John Allegro site. It's a big site. And he was obviously none too happy with the last show that I did concerning the Dead Sea Scrolls and John Allegro and implicating them in a conspiracy. And I think that it was interesting. I'm going to read through these corrections that he has pointed out that I need to make. And I think it's interesting to see that they don't disprove the premise, which is that for 50 years, J.D. Rockefeller Jr., or more or less 50 years, had a total monopoly on the publishing, the reading, the interpreting of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And only during that 50 years is where we have the people on his payroll giving anti-Christian propaganda, and the whole world was in a tizzy. Oh, dear, is it disproving Christianity? I heard on the BBC and these well-funded propaganda pieces say that the Dead Sea Scrolls disprove Christianity, and it wasn't until that monopoly was finally broken here in the last, you know, two decades that we began to see that there was no basis in that. So the premise that Rockefeller must have been trying to put anti-Christian propaganda, not the other way around. You know, I'm not saying that there wasn't a Catholic conspiracy, but the motives of which you need to recheck, considering the facts that we now know. Anyway, let me go into this list of things that he has said here. Okay, he starts off, Rockefellers, yes, as well as the equal biblique and the equals the Vatican. So I think he is agreeing with me that the Rockefeller bit, yes, that's all he says. I don't know if he's just saying, oh yeah, okay, they were on the prey of the Rockefellers, you got me there. I don't know what he's meaning by that. Then he says, the kid did not take them to the dealers. His tribe did. The kid got scared and ran thinking they were ghosts. Here he's referring to the shepherd boy that found the scrolls in the first place. I must have said that he took them to the dealers. Apparently his tribe did. Okay. Eight guys were on the international team. So I think I said varying numbers throughout the broadcast where I was saying five guys, six guys. I think in the written notes, I said seven. Here we have eight guys were on the international team. So, yeah. Yeah, I saw different numbers on different places about that. So, you know, eight guys, seven guys, six guys. Here he lists the name. So, you know, I know Strugnell was added later and Goten later. So, I mean, we can nitpick about how many guys there are on the international team. But you got to, again, stay with the premise that Rockefeller only had, let's say, eight guys for 50 years that were allowed to interpret and publish these scrolls. That's not very many. You know, that's not very objective either. But, you know, I mean, we can't really argue with how Rockefeller wanted to do things. Maybe he wanted to do it his own way, and so we'll just have to leave it at that. And I think that has to do with this next point, too, that he makes. He says, Allegro had a master's degree with high honors from Oxford in philology and language. Several others, were experts as well. Okay, this is referring to me questioning the idea that you would, if you're only going to choose, let's say, eight scholars to look at these and be able to publish these very important documents in Hebrew, you would pretty much want to try to make sure that they knew Hebrew really, really well. But apparently Rockefeller did not see that as a big prerequisite to choosing these eight guys. Again, I'm not saying why, but here he's saying Allegro had a master's degree with high honors from Oxford in philology and language, Okay, that's kind of general. I mean, still, I mean, you look at his Wikipedia here. I mean, it doesn't say he knew Hebrew even. I mean, he says he had a transfer. He was started to train for Methodist ministry, but then transferred to a degree in Oriental Studies at the University of Manchester. Okay, I mean, Oriental Studies does not mean anything. I mean, it seems like you would want to try to explain that he was a super good Hebrew scholar or something, you know? I mean, my point is simple. It's just that him or Strugnell, I mean, Strugnell's a real, the one I really made a big point about. I mean, he was just a young kid, I mean, chosen for no apparent reason, and then later, you know, was the head of these scrolls and made a career out of hoarding these scrolls. I mean, it's fishy. But again, you know, why should we question Rockefeller if he wanted to have people that didn't know Hebrew interpret the Hebrew scrolls? You know, whatever. Again, you're probably correct to say, he did know Hebrew, here's this. I mean, but, okay, but he wasn't an expert on it. I'm sure that if this was done by somebody that was unbiased, they would very much seek to have somebody that would be the best qualified person to do this. And anyway, that was my point on that. So are you saying, I don't know what I said about that, but anyway, let's see here. He says, control was lost over the scrolls to Israel because of the Six-Day War. They were in Jordan, which lost the land in the war. I mistakenly put the 40-day war before. I guess he's correcting his earlier correction here. I don't know what that meant. Maybe I was right. I don't know. Pictures were not at the university, but at the Huntington Library. Okay. I guess this is referring to later when there was a woman who had died that left these film negatives when she was commissioned to take these pictures of the Dead Sea Scrolls for whatever reason. I can't remember. She had basically this negative film roll that was integral later in giving us unedited versions of the Dead Sea Scrolls. We now have another ways to do that now, but at the time that was the threat that made everything kind of start breaking down as far as the monopoly of the fact that this woman had given over these copies of this these pictures, which would allow people to read them for themselves without other people like Allegro or Strugnell telling them what they said. So I guess here he's saying that it was a library, not a university. I don't know. I'll have to check into that because, I mean, it seemed to me that this library was at a university, but whatever, you can have that. The École Biblique is the organization that Father DeVox was a part of. It is basically the Vatican Library, which appears to have been headquartered at the Inquisition Office of the Vatican. Yeah, I know that I don't know what I said, that I said something very similar to that. I don't know what he's referring to there. I probably misspoke something, but yeah, that's pretty much the basis of a lot of this conspiracy thing. And you know, I'll go up you one further that apparently, what was it, the current Pope was head of that office before him, or after him, rather. I think, again, you'll probably correct me on that, but whatever, it doesn't do anything to the premise here. And then he says, not sure that Jews weren't allowed... he's saying, not sure that Jews weren't allowed by the Arabs to read the scrolls. It appears that the team of translators prevented them, not the Arabs. Well, he may want to look that up. Strugnell, who was chosen as the top of his class from Oxford, was studying languages. Oh, he was the top of his class and he was studying languages. Well, let's get him a part of this 8-member team, international team. This guy was studying languages? Well, by God, get him on this team. Fly him out here quickly to Israel. He was studying languages. I mean, please. I mean, Strugnell is a very interesting guy to look at because, I mean, I can't think of any reason. There's no logical reason, if you study Strugnell, why he was chosen to be a part of this international team. There has to be something different. Something we're not being told because it doesn't make logical sense. If you want to correct me, try to figure it. Give me a logical reason why John Strugnell was chosen as part of this international team. I don't know, but except for it was just Rockefeller's whim. I don't know. And his next point is actually about this. He says, Allegro was, in fact, an expert in Hebrew and Semitic languages. He had won awards because of his work. And, you know, I would suggest to him that, you know, he may be right. I mean, I think that John Allegro was the only guy who was not a complete unknown. He had like 5 publications before that as a philologist or whatever you pronounce that. And then, I think, honestly, that's kind of why he was chosen, because of those 5 papers that he wrote before. And I think it gave a clear indication of what Allegro was. There's no doubt that Allegro's talent was in oration. And he was one of these just real slick guys. Obviously, he had clearly made up his mind before before going to the team of which way he was going to vote, if you will. So, I mean, I think that that is a conflict of interest no matter which way you look at it. In the same way that the Catholics have a conflict of interest, he also had a conflict of interest. I mean, surely you would agree to that. But anyway, so maybe he was an expert in Hebrew languages. Maybe he did win awards. I can't find any record of it, but, you know, it's not on his biographies. So maybe he should update Wikipedia and say that he had won awards and was an expert in Hebrew and Semitic languages. I mean, you know, it would be a good edit for Wikipedia. Let's see here. Now he's saying, Allegro was not anti-Christian until after his studies. This is all detailed in his biography by his daughter, Maverick of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Well, he says differently because he's saying that he was studying for the Methodist ministry when he realized that Christianity was a bunch of claptrap, and that's when he decided to go to study in Oriental languages, and that's where, you know, he even details that on the audio on your site. I mean, and the five publications have that tone. I think that that's why he was chosen. I think his skills as an orator were needed for this, this Rockefeller plan. I think that, that's why he wasn't, you know, I don't know. Anyway, let's continue. And, you know, again, the premise is not shaken yet. I mean, these are interesting things. Okay, this is a good one. He says, the Catholic Church founded Christianity. This is something that is absolutely crucial to his argument as a, you know, being loyal to John Allegro and the very same kind of things that, you know, the Allegro, you know, Achaires and all that other stuff, Zeitgeist and the rest of it. You have to have this, because if you don't, the rest of it breaks down. That's why we just have a blanket statement here that says, the Catholic Church founded Christianity in big, bold letters. I mean, I wrote him back and I said, you know, you're going to have a lot, it's historically crazy to say that, but you have a lot of 300 years of dead Christians that would very much disagree with you, because before Constantine or anybody else, Christians were being killed left and right by the Roman Empire. They were writing back to Rome saying, hey, you know, this new sect won't throw a pinch of incense to our gods. I know we're supposed to kill them, but how's the best way to kill them? I mean, history is screaming the fact that Christians were a religion that was very dedicated to this religion 300 years at least before the Catholic Church. So Catholic Church founding Christianity is total bull. And you need it so much because they're saying, you know, if the symbolism of the Catholic Church, the pine tree and the mushrooms and the pantheon that they worship, Saturn and Christmas and all this, you know, sun worship and everything that you can find in the Catholic Church is nothing more than Rome. I mean, they hijacked this movement that they couldn't stop. And it's history. I mean, that's just crazy. But, you know, it just goes to show you the double think that has to happen in order. I mean, and I'm just trying to point out that you have to have that in order to say a lot of the stuff that people say about Christianity. They'll say, well, look at this. You think, you know, what about the Pope hat? The Pope's wearing a fish hat, and that's Dagon worship. And, you know, I mean, so what? The Pope and everything to do with that is pantheistic. They were killing us because they wouldn't worship the gods in Rome, and then when they became the Catholic Church, they tried to get us to worship the same gods and Isis and Mary and the rest of it, and we still wouldn't do it, so the rest of the next 1,000 years is them killing Christians. The Catholic Church, that is. So some benevolent group, that is, they kept killing us because we wouldn't worship the same Roman gods that we wouldn't beforehand. Anyway, that's just crazy. He just says a blanket term, the Catholic Church founded Christianity. I also always find it funny how they made it illegal to read the Bible. So, you know, some control mechanism that they thought that was, they wouldn't let anybody read it. The next statement is, the teacher was hung on a tree, not crucified. Now, this is important because he's saying here that this is referring to the teacher of righteousness who Allegro, when he made his statements, famous now statements on the BBC, that this is right when he got his hands on the scrolls, and he's saying, in his reading of it, that the Catholic, that rather that the Essenes were worshiping a crucified Savior, and he says crucified all the time. Anytime he gets a chance, you can just hear him on the audio on johnallegro.org saying crucified all the time, and maybe he meant hung on a tree, but he certainly says crucified. I think it's because of the impact that it has when he says this group 80 years before Christ was worshiping a Savior that was crucified. And here he's saying that he was hung on a tree, not crucified, and implying that the Dead Sea Scrolls, in fact, say that he was hung on the tree. And that's, again, a misnomer that may have come from Allegro or some Allegroite, but we're still stuck with the evidence that we now have the Dead Sea Scrolls unedited, you know, in our possession, and nobody can find any reference to the Teacher of Righteousness even being martyred, let alone crucified, let alone hung on a tree, let alone any of this stuff. So, you know, I asked him, like, what scroll? Where? Where does it say hung on a tree? You know, you show me that. You just can't say hung on a tree and you know, expect me to just take it as fact when we can't even prove the Teacher of Righteousness was... That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. When Allegro goes on the BBC and has all these things and, you know, has all this time given to him, it's like a 9/11 hit piece. I swear, if you go back and look at those, they give all this time to Allegro at the beginning and at the end and then give, like, bad stuff in the middle. It's like... of the counter-arguments, it's obviously pro-Allegro, and, you know, I would suggest to that the Rockefellers probably had a big hand even in the BBC then. I don't know, I could be wrong about that. But, anyway, so where are we at? Anyway, my point is that it was shock value, and it was later disproven, and now this guy's saying that it's not disproven, and I'm asking him and anybody else that wants to go find it, find me where it says the Teacher of Righteousness was what John Allegro said, crucified. You know, now we don't have to listen to Allegro, we can see for ourselves. So let's go find that. Just send me an email to the scroll, the place, the quote, where does it say it? Okay, then moving on, he says, the sacred mushroom and the cross, new favor and support, you're oversimplifying the issue. Again, he keeps accusing me of oversimplifying the issue, and I'm probably guilty of that, because, that, I mean, that's what I'm trying to do. I don't think this is that difficult to see. I think that there was a major monopoly on these scrolls for far too long, and during that monopoly of the Rockefellers, all we got was heavily propagated anti-Christian sentiment. And after that monopoly was broken, we were able to see unedited versions that disproved that anti-Christian sentiment. It's really that simple. I mean, that implicates the Rockefellers and Allegro as part of a conspiracy, no matter how you look at it. Because, and if you keep quoting John Allegro when you're trying to prove what the scrolls say, then you are in trouble, because there are a lot of people that can read Hebrew now that have access to the same things that John Allegro was reading. So you have a lot of people against one guy, a lot of people that aren't Christians. So, you know, it's really important to look at what they say. Go find the most, you know, I don't know, just go find somebody on that. He says, once again, Christianity came from the Catholic Church. Okay, I know you have to believe that, you know, according to what you currently, your current take on it is, but just please go look that up. It's not true at all. And he says, Rome mostly believed in Mithra, who has a very similar story to Christianity. Very similar story to Christianity is not true. I've just recently looked into this pretty heavily. There was a, somebody just did a lot of research on this. I was privy to, basically, Mithra was a Persian god. There are no written records of him, and it was thousands of years before Christ, or about 1,000. And anyway, there are cave paintings and different artwork and stuff but none of that artwork even suggests anything to do with Jesus or anything like that. So the old stuff has nothing to do with it. There is a mystery religion held by the Romans and some of the kind of middle class Romans were part of this mystery school with Mithras with an S on the end of it, and that's where a lot of this stuff about the similarity of Christ comes in, which you would expect. Hey, if it's after Christ, it probably should just be riddled with similarities, even if they did copy it. But even though they had the opportunity to copy, you know, or somebody had the opportunity to copy from somebody else, it still doesn't exist. And there are still no written records. In fact, the Mithraic scholarship, these are not Christians, these are people that study Mithras for a job, you know, admit there are no written records. So that really puts into, I should say that there are very few written records of the Mithraic mystery religion. And I think that we should question people like Akira S. Again, we've got to keep coming back to Akira S., who will just lie just to sell a book. I mean, just out and out says, you know, that the Mithraic scholarship, I mean, the Mithraic scriptures, I think she quotes in one of her books saying that it says this exact quote that Paul made in Corinthians, I think, or Ephesians, I can't remember, but you can correct me on that if you want. But anyway, she quotes a guy who she actually attributes to two different guys the same quote, one in her latest book and one in anyway, it's just, it's not true. And all this stuff that does come from it, it now comes from a guy who wrote a book in the 1900s about Mithra and this, you know, supposed connections. And for, you know, a good 1900 years, nobody saw any connections. But this guy writes a book who's later been totally disproven. But look, I'm offering people $100 just, and Frank Lordy just put another $100 on it, so that's $200. All you got to do is prove what it says about Mithra and the rest of the stuff that was proved said in Zeitgeist. All you got to do is go to the website, it's conspiracyclose.com/nowheretorun, go to the apologetics section. It's the only thing on there right now. It's just take the Zeitgeist challenge. Just prove it to me. Go find me the text where it says it, and you're going to have a difficult time, and I'm very confident that you can't do it. So when you say Mithra, who is a very similar story to Christianity, is again not based on anything except you read a book that you liked better than the other stuff you'd heard. I'm sorry, but it's not true. I can't think of any other way to prove that to people to go look it up except for offering cash. I mean, it's not going to happen by me just saying, go look it up, it's not true. If $200 is on the line, maybe people will find out that they're being lied to, and that the lie is, in fact, the very same dogma of the Masonic secret societies. And from people like Plutarch and things like that, even the Rosicrucians and stuff believe that they don't even claim, I mean, it's Gnosticism, as in, you know, like this Ormus was, you know, the founder of, I don't know how this goes. I'll keep off that because I'm not studying it. But let me move on here. He says, you're wrong about the Catholic Church on Christianity. See the Council of Nicaea. Okay, again, you know, what do you want me to see about the Council of Nicaea? I mean, oh, the Council of Nicaea. Oh, I was wrong. Christianity was, in fact, founded by the Catholic Church. They all sat in a big room and thought of a religion. Again, man, I'm telling you that history does not agree with that premise at all. And what did the Catholic Church do at the Council of Nicaea? Did they decide on the divinity of God there? That's a pretty bold statement. I think there's a lot of people that have totally disproven that when they were with all these Da Vinci Code debunked and that whole thing. I mean, they pretty much walked through that pretty easily. That shows you that we're dealing with a group of people that for 300 years had been circulating documents, the documents that we still and can prove now have. I mean, they weren't changed by the Council of Nicaea. If they were, then we have the widest bandwidth available, i.e. the huge number of copies in hand that would totally betray us if they changed it then, because we have 300 years of writings before that, or close to 300 years. So anyway, my point is that if they made God, Jesus be God at the Council of Nicaea, and they decided what the canon was at the Council of Nicaea, again, you have these people that are sitting in this room at the Council of Nicaea who have already decided, according to their 100-year-old writings, what the canon was. They had quoted from every book of the Bible. You know, I mean, it was over and done with. The Catholic Church did nothing to do that. But anyway, you still have the problem of 300 years of Roman history of killing Christians and the whole idea of what they were. People say, let's see the evidence. I mean, I can't go through this enough, especially with the Zeitgeist Challenge. It seems like people can't get it through their head. As soon as I say, all I'm asking you to do is just reference me to the original material that Zeitgeist is claiming. It's not that hard. And inevitably, everybody just says, well, Jesus wasn't real. You can't prove Jesus was real. I mean, that's not what I'm asking, first of all. But second of all, I think that there are a lot of Roman records that very strongly suggest. I think it's a misnomer that people just think that there's no evidence whatsoever that a guy named Jesus started a religion, or Yeshua, I guess, more appropriately. And that it was just like the Bible records. I'm telling you, it's a shaky ground to be standing on if you're going with that. Okay, blah, blah, blah. What does he say here? Jesus was symbolism for several things. The sun, the mushroom, the phallic. You're oversimplifying. Again, you're going to have a lot of this with the Catholic Church. If you think the Catholic Church is Christianity, then you're going to find a lot of that stuff. You're going to say, you know, this is just, you know, this is just sun worship. This is just, you know, all this stuff. If you're pointing to things in the Catholic Church and the rituals and the symbolism that they use, and you know, again, you know, what is it? The Second Commandment says don't make idols. And here, that's all the Catholic Church did was make idols. And it was idols, you know, about all kinds of stuff that was their previous religion. So, I mean, again, we have a big, big problem with you pointing to the Catholic Church and saying, look at Christianity, it's based on paganism. No, Rome was. got to get that through our heads. Show me where Allegro retracted his statements about his interpretation that I know of. He kept it until his death and published several more books on the topic. This is a good point. This is about Allegro, who in his first report on the BBC, let me just read what it says from Gnosis.org. This is the Gnostic Society Library. This is very unbiased. I don't see one reference to, in this timeline, to anything biased one way or the other. This is not trying to prove any particular thing. It's just a timeline, dates, names, places. And it says here that in BBC broadcast, Allegro claims to have found evidence that the Qumran sect worshipped a crucified Messiah and suggests that the Christians borrowed a story. Okay, that's on the BBC broadcast. This is the first anybody's ever heard of this. And then DeVox, Milk, Starkey, Stahan, and Strugnell sent a letter to the London Times challenging Allegro. To the London Times, and Allegro retracts the claims and admits they were based on his interpretation rather than on text. Okay, I would look to the London Times for that retraction, just in context here, but, you know, try to find the London Times, 1956, Allegro. I'm sure you're going to find a lot of stuff and find that retraction. I guess that's, again, this is from a totally unbiased timeline of events. If that didn't happen, then you need to write these people and tell them that that didn't happen. And again, we have that kind of thing all throughout this. Okay, let me see. Okay, he says here, this is, he says, when Santa was a shaman, this is about a book by Tony Van Rentergem, I think. In the Middle Ages, when alchemy was at its peak, the mystery plays often featured decorated trees. The church did not like this, although they compromised at first. They soon forbade the tree ritual altogether. How the compromise was interesting, to say the least. They added the Holy Eucharist wafers to the ornaments on the tree, just as the shaman did. They decorated the tree with their sacred meal. Dr. Patrick Harding of the University of Sheffield, named some other names here, all furthered their research into the symbolism of Christmas, both pagan and modern, and answered many of these questions. Okay, again, man, I'm telling you that if you, that Christmas is totally pagan in origins. I mean, you can spend all day. I'll do a show on that. I think it's the most biggest trick in the world. I mean, to get us to put a phallic symbol in our living room and you know, put gifts under the tree, and the old worship of the pagan gods that used to, you know, put the gifts on the tree and the mushrooms and throw the rest of the kitchen sink in there. I'll read your books and agree with them, probably, because it is pagan. Totally. But again, it has nothing to do with Christianity. We have to make that distinction. Nowhere in those 300 years before the Catholic Church were people putting trees in their living room and putting gifts under the trees, and December 25th and all this stuff never happened until the pagans got a hold of Christianity. So when you point to that and say, look, this totally proves that Christianity is pagan or a mushroom cult, it may prove that the Catholic Church is a pagan or a mushroom cult, which is a totally separate issue. You have to understand that. I mean, find me in the Bible anywhere where Jesus said that we should celebrate his birthday on December 25th and put a tree in our living room, and we should elect a guy called the Pope, and he shall be infallible, and, you know, or any of the other things that it says. I mean, if the Catholic Church comes out tomorrow and says, all Christians should now believe in Satan and worship Satan, does that mean that, is that what Jesus meant? The origin of Christianity must have been satanic because the Catholic Church just told us to worship Satan. Don't you see the problem here? I mean, why this is so frustrating to people who are listening to the arguments like John Allegro and saying, that is just claptrap. I'm sorry, I've been using the word claptrap way too much lately, but anyway, okay, let's move on. Sorry for spending so much time on this. I got a lot to do today, and I really, I spent 30, almost 40 minutes on this. So anyway, do I get stuff wrong all the time? Yes, I get stuff wrong every single time I open my mouth. So yeah, I got names, dates, and places, all that stuff I get wrong all the time. I try to do the corrections bit, you know, before every show. You can go to the archives and see I've been doing that since the very beginning, and I continually ask people to do that, to email me the corrections so that I can, you know, retract the things I say. Because generally speaking, I try to do I'm trying to put forth theories and give general concepts and things like that. My concern always isn't getting, you know, pronouncing somebody's name right and that kind of thing. I mean, obviously I understand it's important to get your facts right, especially if they are crucial to the overall concept. And that's important here because I think that it didn't change the overall concept. And I think that's the big point of this whole thing is that, anyway, let's move on. And again, you can go. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be mean. I know my girlfriend tells me that when, you know, I really can come across as, what did she say? Condescending sometimes, and I probably am doing that right now. So I apologize. I really don't want to be like that. But if you disagree with me on this point, certainly go to his website, and I'm sure he'd be happy to hear from you. It's johnallegro.org. It's a really well done site, and it's one of the best websites about John Allegro out there. Johnallegro.org. And in his defense, he did nothing but say good things. It was a real professional email. It was a long list of corrections and all, but it was in the best intent, I think. So, again, no hard feelings there. I hope I didn't come across too condescending. And let's move on. We got a huge show. I'll be right back after this quick break.
Russ Dizdar explains his ministry, Shatter the Darkness.
Almost 20 years now, we've been just kind of just trying to help people, minister to people, share with people coming out of cults, you know, just mind control, the occult, left-hand path stuff. And then we ran into the real underground that's been going on for a long time. And so it has a lot to do with deliverance and dealing with the dark side and power encounters and, you know, as confronting perpetrators of violence on children and ritual abuse. It deals with healing the hearts of the victims and, you know, keeping our guard and trying to do what we can to expose it, stop some of it.
You can visit Russ Dizdar's website at shatterthedarkness.net, where you'll find hours of free MP3s and podcasts, as well as courses for your church or your ministry to begin to learn how to deal with encounters of this nature in a biblical way. Shatterthedarkness.net.
Okay, also I want to encourage everybody to go to revereradio.info, where there is a lot of stuff to do, a lot of very interesting original programming going on there. So revereradio.info, it's also listener-sponsored radio, so they would encourage any help you can give to them. Let's see, you can go to my website, which is conspiracyclothes.com/nowherun. I also want to mention I just came out with a new shirt at Conspiracy Clothes, so you can go to conspiracyclothes.com with no slash, and it's a Ron Paul Rock shirt that I've had in the making for a long time. I'm really excited about it, and so a portion of the profits go to help support Ron Paul 2008, and so it's for a good cause. And I also slashed all the prices there. I call it the devalued dollar sale. And yeah, so I cut the prices pretty drastically, or I probably will end up cutting them a little more. But yeah, that's a good thing there. You can go to conspiracyclothes.com. I should do a Conspiracy Clothes commercial, but anyway, that commercial I did just a minute ago was for Russ Dizdar, and I was really happy to be able to help him out, and he didn't ask for that or anything. I just wanted to do it. I wanted to do it so I could play it on my show, but also that if anybody else wanted to play that same clip. So if you have a podcast or anything you want to play a commercial for and you like Russ Dizdar, you can totally play that clip. It would just help get his word out there. I really, he's one of the people that I really just want more people to know about. I just want, you know, for his message to just explode across the world. It's so crucial that we figure this out. Before I get into, I meant for this show to be another Michael Tesserian show, and that's what the original intent, that's what I've been studying about for the first half of the week. And I got some pretty interesting stuff on that too, so I want to get into that, but I didn't want to really make it all about that because there's just other stuff going on. I just got an email from somebody who has led me to really good information in the past. I think that they are really, really on to something, and they have such a unique perspective, and I want to read her email because it brought a lot of things to my mind that just seem so right and real, and I want to be able to share it with you guys. So let me read this because there are some things that just need to be discussed on that. So let me do that real quick. Okay, I'm going to try to simplify her first 2 points, or actually 3 points. She makes three good ones about maritime law and the beast coming out of the sea. And this is an interesting one. She talks about the firmament. That is, before the flood, there was a worldwide water, I don't know what to call it, sky water, that was surrounded the entire earth that apparently gave like the same temperature all over the world. I mean, you could grow crops in Antarctica the same as you could grow them anywhere else. It was a constant temperature. It was apparently what we enjoyed before the flood. And apparently, according to reading of Genesis 6, I think is when it discusses that, it seems that that firmament was broken and that was what caused this huge flood. Now, basically, she points out that global warming, whether that's real or not, is, it could be a precursor to this being restored, and it might be actually a good thing. She also points out that all the bad weather that we experience as a Earth is caused by the clashing of different weather systems, hot and cold weather running into each other and causing bad weather. So, you know, that's a very interesting point. If the firmament was restored, we would enjoy a lot better physical world. I've heard some really interesting theories about that, too. She also points out that Baal was the god of weather, and Baal is definitely who these Baal, if you want, seems to be the primary god that these globalists are revering. So there's a lot of interesting things there. This next few parts are just really interesting. She makes a few really good points. I believe, Chris, that perhaps the world entered the beginning of the promised age back in 2001. She also goes on to explain that there's a few transitional periods before the different ages, and she's here saying that in 2001 could have been the beginning of this transition period. Listen to her reasoning. I'll just read it verbatim from here on out. I believe, Chris, that perhaps the world entered the beginning of this promised age back in 2001. Let me explain. Each epoch man has experienced was accomplished by the destruction of towers. The Tower of Babel and its destruction preceded the covenant of God made with Abraham and the eventual birth of the nation of Israel. Solomon's temple and the destruction of the two pillars happened just as the church age began. The destruction of the twin towers, the Illuminati symbols, heralded God's eventual judgment and return. Joseph, we understand, was a foreshadowing or a type of Jesus. Chuck Missler, I'm sure, will have teaching on this somewhere, and he does. It's really astounding what he's done with this, and what the Bible has done with it. I'm sure we'll have a teaching on this somewhere. Joseph was given 7 years of fatness to prepare himself and Egypt for the 7 years of famine God told him was coming. I believe that with the destruction of 9/11, God gave the church a sign for us to look for evidence of his prophecies and promises. We have had 7 fat years of his word, the bread of life. We have had 7 years to gather in and prepare. We have had, with the remarkable 9/11 sign, been awakened to times that we live in. It is no wonder that throughout the scripture, God tells us to wake up. Fortunately, in God's goodness, he took it upon himself to wake up his church. Here's my last point. Israel had 42 kings. With the coming again of Jesus, they will have 43. 42 is God's number for division or completion. As our 42nd president, perhaps Clinton completed one epic or age in our country, and the election of the inauguration of George W. in 2001 began another. In many instances, it seems that the U.S. follows Israel with specific dates and numbered periods. From King Saul to Babylon, invasion of Israel, when the nation turned its back on God, 42 kings reigned. There were 42 generations from Abraham to Christ. Abraham to David, 14. David to Babylon, 14. Babylon to Christ, 14. The word tells us that we are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood. The church, then, is the 43rd generation, just as Jesus will be the 43rd king of Israel. Perhaps George W. will be the 43rd and last president of the U.S. And finally this, during Yom Kippur, Israel's atonement was complete. Only after the high priest ceremonially sprinkled blood for the 43rd time. Let me just interject something here. When she talks about George Bush and the connections between Israel and that, it's not like George Bush is holy or anything. It's that America, for some reason, in the Masonic symbolism, has always kind of copied Israel. That's even what the Twin Towers were. That's what I think makes the point she makes about the Babylon and the pillars and the towers so significant is because we do continually copy that Masonic symbolism. It's a long story. You got to really learn a lot about what the mystery schools believe and what they think their origins are in the first place in order to see that connection, I think. But anyway, I'll continue. The church has had 7 years to prepare itself. I hope it has. Just as Joseph, who took a Gentile bride while ruler of Egypt, Jesus has ministered to the Gentile world during this dispensation. He then, when recognized by his brothers, ministered to and sustained the 12 tribes through the 7 years of famine. Shortly, I believe the fullness of the church's dispensation will become apparent, and the ascension of the nation of Israel as God's instrument to reveal God to the world will begin. Indeed, it has begun with the preparations of the temple being made. This week, the solid gold crown to be worn in the new temple by the high priest was shown to the world. Yeah, that's pretty scary stuff when you realize what the implications are of that. I know this has been long, but believe me, I edited down much of what I discovered in the past few weeks. I've come across many things which led me to believe that the rapture of the church will remove us from God's wrath, but perhaps not the tribulation. That's for another post. Okay, that was a really great email. I want to thank her for it. I hope to be able to link you to her blog on the show notes. I haven't quite found it yet, but I know she blogs a little at FaithSpeak. I wasn't able to find it, but I'd like to link you to it. So check the show notes section at conspiracyclosed.com/nowheretorun. There's a lot of really good points here that I want to bring out. First, this idea that 9/11 could have been the beginning of something, and that all the towers in history, the destruction of Babel and the destruction of the temple and the towers there, and then the Twin Towers, I think, all heralded a new age. Couldn't be more insightful. And I think that I thought that as soon as that happened, I saw it as a symbolic move. My idea at the time was a little skewed of who and could be behind it and everything. But the idea that it was symbolic and it meant more as symbol than it did as the rest of it, sure, it helped them usher in the police state and the rest of it. But I think that the major significance was what it did. There's something to that somewhere. And the idea that it was the beginning of 9/11 that everybody started to wake up. I mean, it was that act that started to bring us from nothing to having this figured out. And it was 7 years of fatness. I mean, we have had 7 years to look at this, to research. We've had every opportunity to figure out that this is actually what the Bible was talking about. The Bible was written 2,000 years ago, and it's explaining this New World Order thing as clearly as possible. And there is so much disinformation just to get us to believe that it's not true. I mean, it's just all a bunch of easily disproved lies, but the biggest problem with it is that people are just so willing to believe it without checking their facts. You want to talk about King James Version, you want to talk about the integrity of the Bible, you know, all you have to go look at is the prophecy. None of the debunkers touched the prophecy. That should mean something to you, that 25% of the Bible was prophecy at the time it was written, and nobody seems to try to nitpick at it and say, well, this didn't come true, or this didn't come true. I mean, don't you think they would use that argument if they're really trying so hard to debunk the Bible? That would be the perfect way to do it. This didn't come true. Well, the Bible said this, but it didn't come true. They used to do that before the Jews were back in the land. All the debunkers said, oh yeah, if the Bible's true, how is this, when are the Jews going to come back to Israel? Because it seemed so impossibly ridiculous that would ever happen, because the Jews were nowhere near going to be able to do that. It was impossible. But now, since that's happened, I mean, nobody really says anything. The best thing that they can do is say it must have been written after those events. But you can prove that with the Septuagint and everything else. I mean, we're talking about a book that is 100% right. The way Chuck Missler describes that is so important, that if God is God and he wanted to get a message to us, and he wanted to validate that message so that we would know, well, this is really important. I should really pay attention to this book because it has validated itself. How would you validate that? You would do that by writing history in advance and never being wrong. And that would validate it in my mind. A logical mind would say, well, damn, you know, this thing was written 2,000 years ago, and the older texts have been written some 4,000 years ago, and they were right on the money. and very specific. This isn't like, you know, Nostradamus kind of, you know, vague, this thing might happen. This is like names, dates, places. And we can prove at the time it was written. I mean, we're sitting here with 100% accuracy that nobody seems to question. And then that is validation. You know, that's validation that we should consider our Bibles possibly the most important book on our bookshelf, because it has been validated by a being of outside our time domain. So anyway, moving on. She really makes a good point here, and I really think that the 7 years of fatness is true. We have been given all this time to wake up and to go one way or the other, really, with 9/11. There is a huge amount of misinformation that's trying to push us into this new age way. I mean, people are either going one way or another way. Us as truthers tend to think that we have it all figured out just because we have this part of the puzzle figured out, and then we'll just believe anything about the religious agenda because, you know, it doesn't... We bought a Masonic lie, and it's really easy to prove. I mean, Zeitgeist is literally like Masonic dogma for dummies. It's just making sure that once we figure out that we're being ruled by a one-world government, that we won't stray too far in the thing that they don't want us to. So they've made it really easy for us not to slip up and think anything else. I mean, they're making their dogma known to us, and it's not hard to figure out. Please understand that they need a one-world religion to go with this one-world government, and they themselves are very religious people, and believe it or not, they're not Christians. They are, I don't know what the word you'd use for it, but let's call them Luciferian. And I think that it's just incredibly important what she's pointed out here with that. And I personally, whatever it's worth, I feel like we are really on the verge of something. I think that we might not have any more time left, period. I don't know if there is any more time. But I know that I'm starting to feel more and more like this isn't even like where I want to be. I mean, I don't even feel like a part of this world anymore. I want to just... You know, I mean, it's like I feel so separated from it because it's gone so far from logic, so far from truth. It's like we're being plunged into this just dark, deceptive thing. And I mean, and people that say that I'm just giving up, that's crazy. I mean, I get, you know, I'm threatened all the time. I mean, I'm not giving up. I'm doing everything I can to try to make this happen. I'm not just hoping for the rapture, you know. I mean, that's a common criticism that people have to say about the rapture, that it's just supposed to make people, you know, what, lie down and not do anything to fight it. And I've seen nothing but the opposite from people that believe that. And again, I'm not going to get into that, but I do want to do a show about that recently because I think that there's a lot of misinformation going on about that for a very good reason, something that will blow your mind. I'll get into it here in a little bit. But let's continue with some other things that she's talking about here. The 43 and all that stuff, the comparisons with Israel and the 43s, it's all foreshadowing. Everything about the Old Testament seems to me to be a foreshadowing of stuff. It's such an amazingly put together book. I mean, it's telling a story in things that shouldn't even tell a story. Whenever you see an apparent contradiction, celebrate it because it's leading you to a deeper truth. Like I was on a forum one time when they were talking about that in I think it's 2 Kings when Solomon's talking about this washtub, and it basically through the context of it seems like that the Bible is saying that pi, you know, 3.14, is actually 3. If you do the math, it seems like the Bible is saying that pi is 3. And if you actually look at that and do a study on the words and everything and look at what's being said there, it's ridiculously astounding to think the word, I think it's circumference, in this passage is alphanumerically, as in, you know, the Hebrews had a number for every letter. Alphanumerically, this word adds up to pi, to like the 17th digit, something that mathematicians like didn't even figure out till, you know, much later that we know of. So here we have, not just is it saying that pi is pi, but it's saying pi to like the 17th digit, you know, an impossibly amazing feat. I have to look at those numbers exactly, but it's something really, really close to that. Also, I wanted to talk about the temple. She mentions here that they just made this breastplate. If you read, I think it's in Leviticus, where they're, it may be Exodus, where they're describing the breastplate that says, like, holy of, it says a certain thing that's engraved on it, and it's very important. It took them like a year to make it. It's suggesting that they're rebuilding the temple, which is important. It's very, very important. And what's really important to note about the rebuilding of the temple, we shouldn't celebrate this necessarily, except for it means that we're really freaking close to this happening. But keep in mind, anybody that's moving to rebuild the temple is probably, at this point, going to be driven not by the Spirit of God, because God doesn't need a temple and sacrifices to begin again. He has already done away with that. He gave a perfect sacrifice. So it's not God trying to rebuild the temple to start sacrifices. God does not feel that we need sacrifices. But the Antichrist absolutely must have the temple rebuilt in order to do what he needs to do. So to have these kind of things happen is not a, we shouldn't celebrate that, like, oh great, let's donate money to rebuilding the temple or whatever. That's not going to be a good thing, and just remember that. There's a really interesting article somebody posted on the comment section of the show that I did about the Sermon on the Mount and whatnot. On the Podomatic site, if you go there, you can check a link there to a very, very interesting article about the new city hall and the Rockefellers and all this stuff that they're building in Israel. How the Antichrist, if he's anywhere, he's all around Israel. Watch Israel. It's very, very important. Okay, I just rambled on and on and on. Let's try to move to topics. Thanks to another topic. Thanks for the incredible email. There's a lot to think about. Let's move on. Okay, you know what I think I'm going to do? I think I'm going to split this into two different podcasts. This one being an hour long, and then I'm going to do another one about Tessarian and Maxwell and all that kind of thing, and the Rosicrucians and all this weird connection. So I'm going to probably split this up. Before I leave, I want to take the advice of the lady who sent me that email. And she said that it was on the suggestion of her turning off her TV that she started just doing research and just couldn't imagine the quality of life difference, that she encouraged me to, again, tell people to turn off the television. First of all, one very good reason to turn off the TV is that, and they were proving back in the 70s, they had perfected it, that they were piggybacking hypnotic signals, that is, signals of people, hypnotizing you, and they were able to get it on commercial radio and television signals. So you could be watching American Idol, and literally an inaudible voice is getting past your ears and going directly into your brain, telling you to do something. And hypnotic suggestion is so powerful if it can get past you actually discerning it at all. That's the whole problem with hypnotism. If you don't judge what's being said, your subconscious will just do it. So that's how dangerous it is to have a signal going directly to your brain, and that it can be carried on a signal that's getting out of your TV. So that's a really good reason not to watch it. Not to mention that it's just a quality of life thing. It really does get your brain to like beta waves. I mean, have you ever noticed that as soon as the TV goes on, it doesn't matter if it's commercial or whatever, you just kind of like stand there and look at it, and then 3 hours go by and you're like, oh, what happened? Oh, I had so much to do today. Oh well. Just go do an experiment. Go and hit the power button on your television and just give it about, 20 seconds there, and see if anything happens different. Like, do all of a sudden you start remembering that you have things to do, and that you, oh my goodness, I was supposed to go down and do this. I got laundry to do. Oh, I forgot I had to, it's just a quality of life difference. And not to mention the fact that it's brainwashing on like at least two levels. The one that you have no idea about unless you've done mind control studies, military mind control studies, and on patterns of and piggybacking signals, or if you just know that it's they're just slowly in content giving you things that are suggesting any number of various things. It's the perfect tool, and you'll just I mean, I'm telling you what, I don't even... It's like I'm going to go outside one day and everybody's just going to be doing something crazy. And I'm going to be like, what is going on? I mean, people just follow the TV so much. We really need to get off of it. And I'm telling you what, this, it's like it neutralizes so many great people out there. There's probably some people listening to me that are so talented, so much to offer, that are just being handicapped by the various things that they use to do just that. TV is a huge handicap. It keeps people like this wonderful woman who has so much to offer in research would have never done it, you know, if she just didn't get out of that mold. So please do that. Again, start a podcast, start whatever. It's so easy to do. Go to podomatic.com or any other site like that. It makes it just as easy as can be to start up a podcast. Even if you don't have the hardware here, I'm today, even though I don't have my regular setup, I'm just podcasting with the mic in my computer, and so, you know, it's really easy to do. Just a few clicks here, it just walks you right through it. You don't have to be a genius, you don't have to know how to do anything. You might need to download a program or whatever just to make sure it's recorded well and everything. We will need to do that, but that's about it. Okay, guys, I'm going to go ahead and split this up, and I'm going to do another program about Michael Cesarian, Jordan Maxwell, the lies like that, and I'll be right back. So chris@conspiracyclothes.com is my email. You can go to the website, conspiracyclothes.com/nowhere to run. Let me know what I've done wrong, and I'll correct it in the next show. Thanks, guys. Take it easy.